Oh my God, what's up, Brian?
Where are you?
Philip.
How are you doing?
I'm in a little garden room. I call it kind of my my shed when I want to get away from the girlfriend.
Nice.
So in Ventura, California.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah, you guys, what, you guys both go to Santa Cruz?
I used to live in Santa Cruz and went to college there at UCSC.
Yeah.
I tried to go to, I thought you were in Santa Barbara, man.
I did, and then I met a girl and she bought a house here.
Oh, okay.
So I'm close. I'm like 35 minutes away from Santa Barbara.
Okay. I tried to get into that school. I auditioned to play the string bass in the different colleges in the UC system. And Santa Barbara did not want me. Santa Cruz took me.
And that's how you played in school. That's
right. Yeah, string bass. And I got like you probably can't see him, but I got like a billion.
I see like the corner one right there. Yeah.
Yeah, there's like a billion instruments behind me. So where all my money goes.
If I zoom out here, like this is currently now turned into we're remodeling like a kitchen. Right
now? Oh yeah, you're in a full gut rehab there.
So this is actually just like holding zone. So like all the painting for all the drawers and stuff are sitting all around me. That's pretty sexy.
This is the true nomadic lifestyle, right? Well, hey, what do you say we get started? Are you ready?
Let's do it.
All right.
I'm feeling good.
All right, hey everybody, we got a great episode today. I've got Brian here from Nomad Goods. Thanks so much for coming, and I appreciate you being here because I know that with a nomadic lifestyle, you could probably be working from anywhere, and you're choosing to work at your home right now to talk to us. And I think the thing that you guys have done over the last, it's been 10 years, right? Over 10 years.
11 years, yeah.
That's incredible. And I think what's amazing about it is you seem to have timed it a little early. We've got a lot of work from home stuff that has happened throughout the pandemic. And it's almost like you guys were made for that moment. Is that how you guys are feeling right now as we've sort of come out of the pandemic world?
Yeah, I'd say it was like really still part of what was happening even like 11 years ago. It was just a little bit more niche. Mm-hmm. Like around then, like what was going on? Uber was launching, Airbnb was launching. Obviously Shopify was really kind of hitting the scene. And a lot of people around me, like I didn't have a car, like lived in San Francisco and was personal hotspots were like becoming normal on the iPhone. And so it was all kind of happening. So there was definitely like this coffee shop work remote thing. And now it's just kind of gone mainstream finally. And then I think now with Starlink, have you guys tried Starlink yet?
No.
The Elon Musk internet thing?
I haven't tried it.
100% would recommend.
So that really allows you to go literally anywhere and do sort of anything you want.
Yeah, we were just down, we had like a Sprinter van, we were just down in Baja and did a solid 3 weeks like from the beach.
Oh my
and
God.
Like perfect internet. I mean, like, to be fair, it's like, it's not as glorious as it sounds. Like there's bugs and it's hot and you're sweating and, you know, it's actually really a whole tough thing, but like you can do it. You can totally do it. You can Zoom the whole time. The internet's great. So.
Man, I got my boy Elon.
Your boy?
I don't know. He's a guy, Elon.
First name basis. With Elon. Well,
it's really amazing because the mainstream sort of work from home thing, work from anywhere, the nomad goods sort of mantra, I don't know what you guys call it, like an ethos.
Yeah.
It become very popular, obviously. And it, like you said, it's taken off. I see that represented by being able to see your products across the street from the tannery. There's a Best Buy and you can go see the Nomad stuff at that store. I think that's a really big
deal. That's wild. Yeah.
I think it's a really big deal. I mean, especially it must be exceptionally startling to you, I would assume, knowing that it started in your brain and now it's in the real world. But what's it like having your product in a store like a Best Buy?
Well, I mean, I hope I don't get in trouble for this, but frankly, what's more interesting to me is when I'm at like a highly curated, like small store in like Japan or like Indonesia, that's like kind of putting some of like the best goods together. That's where the curation feels like kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, Best Buy does have like kind of everything under the sun a bit, so it doesn't feel quite as special to be in there, though it is, you know, a good validation and it's exciting and everything. But yeah, there's something to, you know, walk into a Selfridges or somewhere like really curated and you're like, wow, that's very cool.
Well, what's your favorite curated spot then that you guys are selling at?
For a while, honestly, it was Huckberry. And when they were small, like Huckberry has gotten a lot bigger and they've expanded a lot. But back in the day, we would walk our goods down to their little warehouse in San Francisco and hand drop them off for every shipment. And that was really cool. Actually, a lot of Southeast Asia absolutely kills it. Their attention to detail and design of their stores are like out of control. Shout out to anyone down there. And they're really super creative and it creates like this amazing space that sort of, we've gotten used to the Apple store a bit. Like they're pretty and everything, but they're all the same and they're not really that special anymore. Mm-hmm. They've kind of taken the same thing down there and put their whole wild creative twist on it. And it's cool.
How does that work? Do you, those smaller stores or even the ones that aren't so small, do you approach them or do they approach you or does it go both ways?
The ideal is they come to you, right? It's like if Horween, like if you had to go out there and pound pavement and sell, like it's just harder to like win people over. But when people come to you knowing that you're the best, like that's the position you want to be in. Yeah.
That would be nice if that was the case.
Yeah. it's never that easy, right? No, but those are the great leads.
Yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of that where, I mean, that is the easiest. Like there's no sales work because people are already coming to you at that point.
Yeah. But, I mean, when we came to you, I just like, honestly, I was like looking on the blogs and trying to figure out like what's the best. And it was like, well, everything seems to clearly be pointing here. So, you know,
you bought the propaganda. Hey guys. I won you.
Yeah. I want leather and how do I get it? Was really the conversation, not really like around, right. You know,
I mean, it's not the easiest thing to do. I mean, now that you know and have a relationship with Nick and the tannery, it's probably feels a little easier, but I meet a lot of people that are like, where do you get this stuff? How do you get it? I was watching a video yesterday on YouTube about Origin, which is like the Jocko Willink boot company in Maine. They're trying to, they have this ethos about made in Maine, made in the USA. And they're, what's the name of the tannery out there that went away recently? There's a tannery in Maine that was the last tannery and they're gone now. So they had to find an alternative. So it's not particularly easy to source materials, or I'm assuming anything these days is pretty challenging to get. But what I was curious about too, maybe we can go down that path a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
But I think sourcing materials is neat and interesting, but I think what's incredible is how you're able to exist in a big box Best Buy as well as that niche like specialty store. I think I'm also curious about the design and how you guys come up with a product that can work in those two worlds.
Yeah. In terms of like sourcing, like I've been to, you know, a lot of these fairs, like material fairs, and, you know, everyone will set up booths and it's often just booth after booth of like the same kind of generic blah. You know, is it from fabric to leathers to microfibers to kind of plastics or whatever? And it's just a like a price game, a sales game, a supply game. And it's nothing. There's no real like love or art or passion in it. And you'll stumble upon like a very few. And I will often run into the booth, like hands up in the air. I've found one, you know, and I'm all excited and I'll chat with them. And they're so excited to finally chat with someone who's excited too. Because everyone's just talking price and this and that. It is hard to find the good stuff. It's not that hard to find the mediocre stuff. there's boatloads of it, but trying to find the good stuff, the people that are actually caring and, you know, zooming in on the details, they're really, really caring about the details. That is hard to find. So, I mean, you guys have, is Tannery Row up the site?
Yeah. What do you mean up? Tannery Row's a business. We're actually trying to have John from Tannery Row on the show here. You know, John.
Wait, don't you guys sell? How do just small craftsmen buy from you guys?
From the tannery?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we used to do it direct or try to do it direct, and we were terrible at it because we're just not set up.
You're just leather nerds. Love it.
Well, it's just like from a customer service standpoint, we're better. It's like it's always been a business to business thing, and we were always trying to take care of or, you know, fulfill these smaller orders and just could never figure it out.
Called Tannery Row?
Yeah. So Tannery Row is a different business that's owned by John Cullerton, who's the head of sales. So it's a complete.
Yeah, John's the man.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So that's our retail partner. So they buy in production quantities so that we can not trip over ourselves through production and billing. And then they'll, break it into smaller, batches or lots, and then do all the customer service and shipping.
John, for all listeners, is like our point of contact when we talk with Horween. He's a great guy.
Yes, we're gonna have him.
That's cool. Yeah, I have to chat with him about that. That's really cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So
that's cool. So all you craftsmen, that's a great resource to get your hands on some Horween.
Tannery Rose, where it's at.
Yeah,
yeah. And it's nice because they have got a relationship with John already. So if it's a very scalable model by design. I mean, if someone orders two pieces and then they're like, well, this took off on Kickstarter. I need, 5,000 feet. I mean, they just come straight to the tannery. So it's a good system.
Yeah. It's a nice system because you do need to like trial and test stuff out and get your foot in the door, because we started on Kickstarter. And so like, right, you kind of want to start out, but you can't order 500 square feet or, 1,000 square feet off the bat. You're not even sure if it's going to work and everything. So, and that's how we started. We just started kind of messing around, got a couple hides. I think we even got our first off tannery back in the day, and started prototyping it. And I think our factories, our factories are used to kind of the mediocre kind of manufactured leather. Which is like 50% leather, 50% plastic.
Shots fired.
It's true. And so all their machines and processes and everything is just dialed, like their QC reports, quality control reports and everything is just completely tailored to like that. That is what leather is. Like, that's it. So when they get like, real like aniline dyed, with the wax all over the place, leather, broke. Like, they were very scared. Like, no QC process worked. There's all these little tests that they do for scratch resistance and everything. And on a leather that's cool, you actually want it to scratch. You want it to like do all these things. You want the wax to kind of smear around and like, in a minute way. So we had to like sign off on documents, like okaying it, like this doesn't pass standard. This doesn't pass standard, and make our new standards and everything. So it's clear to me, how rare it is, for example, to be using something like Horween in like a Best Buy, like kind of getting back to that. It's not even like the supply chain doesn't know what to do with it.
Oh, absolutely. I think that the scaling of a business with a naturally finished leather in today's world might not be possible. I mean, there's like another world from like the 70s where, people, maybe there was no alternative, but these days when you have to make tens of thousands of the same thing every time, it's nearly impossible to do it with a piece of Nick's Dublin, for example, that's not heavily painted. I mean, do you want to enlighten us a little bit about that, Nick? Like, is there a...
Sorry.
Don't paint your leather, kids.
Yeah, don't paint.
I think there's a place.
You need some. Yeah,
I sometimes. Think there's a place for it.
There definitely is. I think it's a that whole notion is a byproduct of manufacturing getting bigger. So I think that you're right. For a long time, there weren't that, I mean, there were always alternatives that were more finished and less finished, but I think that generally people accepted leather as leather more in the past. And then as manufacturing numbers and scalability went way up, and you know, quantity became the driver of price. And the only way to make things consistent and quickly is to have all of your inputs be consistent, that drove people to request or to purchase more and more finished leathers, because that's the only way to really achieve something that's super uniform. And then that just trickles down to the consumer. I mean, the consumer then starts to accept that as the normal product and the thing that's out there, because that's what they're seeing the most of. And then when you start to reintroduce the old way of doing things, I mean, it's interesting because it's the old way of doing things and there are people that know about that and appreciate it, but you've lost such a big chunk of the market that sort of just understands the product. And I think that to the credit of a lot of consumers, that people will listen and you can explain what something is and you can win a lot of people over. But I think it's especially challenging in the space that you're in, Brian, with tech, because people don't want a phone that looks different every time they buy it. They want it to be exactly the same. And then they want to put something on it that looks the same too, generally, I think. So I don't.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And like you said, like there's the group of people that like wrap their head around it, get it, and come back year after year. And like those are the true Nomad fans. Like they get it. They're excited for it. They want it. And they get annoyed if it's not that, right?
I think it's an interesting concept to meld together cutting edge technology with like 100-year-old leather tanages and sort of put those in one product. Was that a conscious choice by you guys, or you just like accidentally stumbled across this?
No, I think I have a natural want for like the kind of authentic material thing, like whatever it is. If it's going to be metal, it better be the metaliest of metals. You know, if it's going to be leather, it better be the leatheriest. And like, I'm really desperately trying to find like the best plastic. It's like, yeah, we use plastic. I wanted to use the coolest plastic, yep. You know, so it's like, that's just sort of a natural thing. Like ask my mom.
What's the coolest plastic? Do you have one?
You can do some cool stuff. I mean, so you can add stuff into it. So it's just like a resin, and like with resins, you know, you're used to like putting carbon fiber into resins, and that's a composite. You can do other things, like there's glass filled nylon where you put fiberglass shreds in, but you can add in like metal particulates to make it really dense and heavy. You can add in other powders to make it sound deadened. You can make it like a bit of an interesting thing, or you can just use really high quality polymers that just feel, for me, it's like, it's all about density. Like if you pick up something where it's a really like, low density kind of, high brittle plastic, you touch it, it makes a really high pitched clinking sound, and you just touch it and you go, that thing's cheap. And then you grab another thing and it's like, huh, that thing's stout. Like you pick up like an Apple AC adapter, feels stout. It doesn't feel cheap. If you pick up something about the same size, it'll feel chintzy.
Right.
And you don't know exactly what it is. There's engineering in there, but it's also just the plastic they chose.
Let me interrupt your thought there.
There a headphone company that was putting weights in their headphones to make them feel heavier?
Probably. We put weights in all of our stuff. There's weights in that thing. That one actually is pure zinc, but there are some steel weights to increase the...
So this is, what do you call this? The charging station?
That's different though. That's supposed to stay put, not
go on
your head.
Have you felt this? Feel this thing.
I have the oh man, yeah, this heavy. It's heavy.
Like literally the mass of a brick.
Yeah.
And I love it for
it's
that.
It's almost
reason.
Like pure metal. It's like, it's a lot.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So I should...
That's one casting with like a, you know, with rubber and stuff on top and glass, but like it's basically one giant casting.
I hand this to Nick and to show you in front of you to demonstrate that I am a fan. I have many, charging stations, especially once the wireless stuff started coming out, or the MagSafe charging. I've been both, actually. This is the MagSafe one, but I have those like charging mats that you do too. And cable, my wife steals my cables.
I still like a good cable, don't get me wrong.
I mean, there's something about a nice, don't know. I've got like nice braided cable. I got tons of crap everywhere. There's something about, and actually this is one of your cables. There's something about a nice braided cable that I get pleasure from. And think of what you're talking about with like the heft of something or like a brass pen. It's just like something feels correct about it. And I like that. Are you designing these products based around the material then? That's kind of what the sense I'm getting from you is it sounds like you're navigating different possible materials and then choosing products based on that. Is that correct?
That's one way to think of it. Yeah, for sure. So like the term they use is CMF, like color material finish. So like that's going to be like a kind of a primary component in the way we think about design. First, it's like, oh, it needs to be like, you know, a leather, fully leather encapsulated thing. Okay, then let's go figure out the details. Others can come up with like spec driven. So like it needs to have this drop resistance, it needs to have this, and then we'll figure out the material to make that work. So we kind of do the kind of more CMF first.
Okay. I want to go back to you. I derailed us from many questions, which is how this podcast seems to go, but I'm still curious about the design. And I'm curious if when you talk about selling in a big box store versus a little bit more of like a boutique style thing, are there different product types? Do you have a mix of products that go to the one place and not the other and vice versa?
Yeah, definitely. I think that for us, like it's not super complicated. Like there's, we're an accessory. So like a boot company is an accessory to your feet. It's not really, you know, like a thing, but like if you're a sock company, you want to be sold in a company or a place that sells boots. So like, you know, it attaches to the sale of a boot. So for us is we attach to the sale of an iPhone. So if you buy an iPhone, there's a 30% chance you're going to walk out the door that day with a case. So for us, it's all about the attachment. And so it's about what is the store selling. So is the store selling a lot of iPhone Pro Maxes? Like, great, then we'll assort Pro Maxes. And they're selling only white iPhones. I'm like, great, then we'll do a light colored leather, you know, for example. But so it's all about that attachment rate, which makes sense, you know, being an accessory. And that's sort of how you think of it. And it just sort of naturally works out there. You can assort 50 products and then you find out the ones that are working. So, yeah.
How do you get that?
I want to go back actually to the one thing about a Horween leather and like it having issue in mass production, Nick, that you were talking about.
What are you talking about?
No.
No, I know.
In terms of like, you know, an ability for consumers to even like think about it and understand it as leather, you know, we've kind of moved on to like the new kind of like understanding of like leather. So, okay, get this. Okay. So totally right. We have our fans that love Nomad leather and Horween and everything. Everything's great. But when you go on Amazon, it's like automated retail, you know, of the future. And people are really conditioned to like the kind of basic, you know, version of leather now, the fake version of leather. So we were getting, you know, fairly high return rates, and Amazon doesn't really they don't really take it into account. So we actually got our account completely shut down for a year because they said we were selling returned items. Damage. We were selling damaged goods, which was the Horween leather, and we were trying to explain to them, like, no, this is real leather. This is actually what it is, and we took a year of fighting with them to understand that this is actually an acceptable product, and it's not our fault.
Story of my life.
So it was kind of a crazy.
I'm sorry.
I get it. Yeah.
What were those customers on Amazon saying? I guess you don't see much feedback other than a box they tick saying like defective goods.
Yeah. Like on our website, they've kind of bought into the whole like vision of like what it is and why they're there, and they're excited. Amazon, it's a little bit like you only get like a bullet point or two, and you know, people don't quite get it, and they get it in the mail and they're kind of like, huh, what the heck's this? So I don't necessarily blame the consumer. You know, also Amazon shopping and Amazon shoppers are a bit of a different filter from the kind of like super prosumer kind of shopper out there. So yeah, they were like returning it as like used or defective or something like this.
Well, I'm still missing it, like, because, so I'll tell you my anecdote is I'll have customers that will pick up a Dublin wallet for me or a Shell Cordovan wallet, and they'll go, "Oh my God, like, I thought this leather was nice. It's scratching." I'm like, "Yeah, dude, it's not diamond."
No, exactly.
is that what you were seeing on Amazon?
Yes. It was scratching or, you know, like a little scuff would happen in the first, you know, 10 minutes. And, you know, it's like, yes, that's the point. That's what's cool. That's what's awesome. And so Amazon just talking about like the machine that is like today, the factories didn't know how to deal with it. Amazon didn't know how to deal with it. So it is like a challenge to do, which I think is just going to make it even more rare and even more like special. So the people that know and care will have to seek it out with
that. I mean, I still feel like that's amazing that you can exist in a Best Buy as well as a world that sells aniline leather, you know, leather that's going to change over time. I think that's incredible. I want maybe Nick to explain to us how a finish. So we could make a material, a leather that is very tough on the top that is more scratch resistant. But my suspicion, that is a little bit backed up by some additional anecdotes, is that by applying more finish to the material will give you less ability, or give the leather less ability to develop and change in a pleasant way. Maybe you can enlighten us a little bit on that.
Are you leading the witness? Yes.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, I don't know how to ask that question.
No, I know what you're saying. I know.
Yeah. We went down this road too. And then there's a point where you're like, all right, we've lost it.
There's a couple of things in there. I mean, yeah. So the more consistent you make a natural material like leather or wood or whatever, the more you have to do to it to make it consistent. So that's adding, whether that's dark stains, I mean, that helps, or paints, and that helps even more, or, you know, you're sanding it down and doing a combination of those things. I mean, it's the same thing. Wood and leather is the same in that regard. So it's just, you know, it depends on what you want, but the more you do to it and the more you put on to it, it changes. You're changing the substrate, so you're changing the way it looks, and you're changing the way it feels too, or some combination thereof. But I think that, like with working with you, Brian, there was an intersection point where there was sort of an acceptable amount of variation variation in feel and aging characteristics to how consistent it needed to be. And I think that was factory driven. But that's every customer. I mean, the people that want something that's totally naked are making not a lot of stuff, and they can be picky about where they're cutting and what they're cutting. And the people that are making a ton of stuff really fast need something that's really consistent, because that's just the nature of the manufacturing process and the demands on the inputs, whether it's leather or plastic or whatever, I think. But yeah, I mean, I think the point is that there's a natural balance you have to find between the two, between being supernatural and feeling good versus being totally painted and finished.
Okay. Well, that's what Brian was saying, is I think that makes it more rare and a treasure.
Yeah. And I think the Nomad stuff is on the
treasure end of the spectrum.
It's on the treasure. It's on the individual attention through manufacturing end, where you have to spend more time. And it's not going to look like a car interior. It's not going to look the same after you sit on it for 2 years. It's going to look different after 2 days.
I don't want to take away from our guests. I really want, I always feel bad like giving my stories, but the things that I see with the leather that, again, make it a treasure, to your point, Brian, is that people get that scratch the first time they wear it. But the part that they might immediately get upset because, hey, my brand new thing is scratched. Of course, like, that seems strange. The thing that people miss about Nick's leather in particular, and there's many other tanneries that make incredible stuff, but the thing that they miss about that material is that by beating it up, go hard on it. It's like the harder you wear this stuff, the better it gets, which is not something you can say about most things. So I think people getting a little deterred by a little scratch on day one is sort of missing like the real story
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, I think we should like lean into that a little bit more. It's like, yeah, it is one of the only like repairable, self-repairing kind of materials out there. You know, we obviously, you know, tell everyone to like be patient and relax, but it's almost like lean into it.
I tell my customers, go hard on it, man. Like, just give it everything you got. And if it breaks, like, we repair the stuff for free. So you got nothing to lose. Just beat it up. But I've also come across some stuff on Nomad about sustainability. Does that product lifestyle come into factor for you guys with your sustainability focus?
Yeah, I think that like it's like, frankly, it's tough, right? Like, there's nothing sustainable really about like metals. Like, they just take a lot of energy to make. Like, leather takes a lot of energy to make. But like, if we're going to use like metals and leathers, and we're going to try to do the best we can, right? You guys are made in America, have great filtration. You know, I've been there a bunch. You guys are in Chicago. Like, the regulators are all over you and you're doing great. And that's not the case everywhere, right? So, you know, we're obviously, if we're going to use it, we're going to use people that are doing the best out there.
What other efforts are you guys doing for sustainability? I just got a package in yesterday, which, by the way, this will be my favorite. I got my first pair of Air Jordans. I noticed on the Nike box, it says, hey, we're 100% carbon neutral. And, you know, all the materials that we sent to ship this box is somehow we're going to account for. I didn't read farther than
we do that. We've done that for a while.
What is that like?
To be totally fair, it's a bit of like a temporary kind of solution. No, not even a solution. It's a temporary measure. It's not solving like the problem, but it is putting money into helping to solve some of like the kind of most egregious, like immediate actions. But it's not like, it's not fundamentally lowering like our CO2 footprint. So what we're doing is you all these companies, we just take everything, put into a calculator, spits out a dollar amount, and then we buy carbon credits that are doing like a rainforest reclamation in Brazil or some other project in Africa. And it's great. It's like good. It's funneling money to good causes. But the better thing to do is actually to make materials that don't use as much energy, right? Mm-hmm. In better ways. That's actually the real thing. And the kind of greenwashing, frankly, of this carbon neutral thing is that it's not really solving the real core issue, is that the Jordans should be made out of, you know, recycled this and that, or whatever. And same with us. The problem is material science is not quite there yet. It's rapidly catching up, but you know, making really good, you know, recycled or bio-based plastics is frankly not easy. So our goal, like coming out in the next like year, is, you know, 50% recycled plastic, and bringing out more on the actual material front. So it's a long game. It's a tough game. And, you know, we're committed to be playing in the right direction, but it's by no means an easy thing to solve.
It seems especially complicated for you, if I can guess.
You project.
Yeah. Because I think and this is something we talk about. And I talk about a lot. It's like, if you're going to make the impact or have the impact, then make something that does its job, it's going to last. So, you know, use good plastics or metals and make sure that you make something that's going to hold up for as long as possible. So you're not just using it to then dispose of it, because that's impact too. It's not just the manufacturing. It's what happens to it after it's done.
Yeah.
And I think that's
just, you need to make a good thing for sure.
Yeah.
And then there's a bit of like a tricky thing is people compare you to like, I don't know, like some basic backpack maker, and like, well, they're doing it all out of hemp and stuff. And it's like, yeah, I'm not making a pure hemp iPhone. Like it's just like,
that's what I was going to say.
Your sound mixing board and your laptop, like case and stuff, these things that we like these are the hard things. Like it is relatively easy to make a backpack or like a coffee cup or something. Like, yes.
Yeah, if you can do it in your garage, like go make an iPhone in your garage. Like
it's yeah, it's like it's getting hard. Yeah. Like, and if you make a case with protection and multiple materials yeah. and like a wireless charger, like it frankly, it's not going to be that easy.
I think part of the reality of the world that you live in, and to be pointedly critical right now, is part of that world that you service, the market that you service with the tech, is technology changes so quickly. So when we were saying, hey, well, let's make the best case, sure, but you know that phone, maybe people are only using that phone for a year and then they need a new case. So that, I mean, there's a little bit of a bummer there too with the technology, you know.
Totally. And
yeah, I don't know where I'm going with. There's no question there other than just to be critical of ourselves as consumers. Because I do, too, you know, I'll actually go 3 years on a phone, but I know a lot of people that do the upgrade every year.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're protecting.
Hopefully, something. Though, that this new MagSafe and then USB-C are like relatively stable for 10 years or so. But I think that would be foolish for me to actually say that. I think that's been the dream. Like many times, and it about every 3-4 years, it something changes, and we all have to upgrade our chargers as well. The one thing that Apple has been really consistent on is the Apple Watch. The bands have worked now for nearly 8 or 9 generations, which is wild.
I remember teaming up with you on the Apple Watch bands those 10 years ago. You came to the tannery and you said, "Hey, look at this watch. This is the next thing." I said, "What are you talking about?" And he's like, "This is the the best-selling watch of all time already." And I thought what was cool about it was you already had this foresight to think about, well, everybody around the dinner table, or say you're going out to a business meeting and like everybody's wearing the same Apple Watch. Well, you said to me, it feels strange to be sitting next, maybe it was Noah that said this to me. It's like, we've noticed that it feels strange to have the same exact watch. So we need to differentiate the bands. Tell me about the progress that you guys have done and sort of the starting point of the watch straps that you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like a really fundamental kind of thing that we got on early was Apple Watch. The bands are a fun space because they span multiple generations. They really change the whole like look of it. Like an iPhone case does change the look of it, but kind of it ultimately is a black screen on the front and you really just get the back to play with. There's something fun about the bands is like it really can make it a completely different band. Like if you look at our titanium band compared to like a traditional leather band, it's a fully different watch. So it's a fun canvas. We can kind of play. It feels like play a bit more. It's great.
How do you, projecting my own self interests. Do you guys do multiple sizes on the watch bands?
Yeah, it's mostly for us is the 45 millimeter is mostly the sales, but there is the 40-41 millimeter, which is like maybe 10% of our sales, I think.
Yeah, those are the older sizes.
Those are just the smaller size. There's size. So the 41 and 40, there's the 38, 40, 41. They actually use all the same lug. The screen size just increased. Right. And then there's the 42, 44, 45, and the Ultra, which are all the screen sizes just increasing, but it uses the larger lug.
Yeah. The door cap. Do you have to make different SKUs for each of those?
No, that was what was amazing. That was a nice thing that Apple did, and kudos to them. They allowed the lugs to work between almost 9 years or so of Apple Watch, I think at this point, 8 years. Might be wrong in that, but probably about 8 years. And between the different sizes, they'd come out with a new Apple Watch and it started as 42 millimeter, went to a 44, went to a 45, and then the Ultra. And your band you bought on day one, 8 years ago, still works on the newest Ultra, which is great.
Do you feel like if they had a proprietary connector that was somehow like authenticated digitally, that they would have changed the size every time? Or are they not?
Do you think they have that? That is like a bit of a funny topic. Like people say Apple's not changing to USB-C because they want to make money on Lightning. And I just don't think that's how Apple like thinks. And I don't think the CFO either thinks like that. I think that in like probably 30 minutes of like subscription revenue, they'd make like an annual revenue of MFI, you know, something like insane. Cause like we don't pay Apple that much for the Lightning connector. Like I think people think they make just boatloads of money, but they make like 30 cents, you know, a cable. And they have to pay a whole team to deal with us. So that part of it goes into like just the cost of dealing with us. So like they maybe make like 10 cents on a cable. So they might make, you know, I don't know, $30, $40 million a year.
Not a big deal.
No, I really don't think that it, that's driving.
Like, I view them with a nefarious lens, I suppose.
I bet they spent $30, $40 million in a matter of weeks on the EU like lawsuit for Lightning. Like it is not the reason why they're dealing with the Lightning. They like Lightning because they think it's cool.
It's slim. And it's also, it's really fun to talk about conspiracies too.
Totally. No, I don't. I actually don't think Apple is doing that or cares. I think they really do want to make like the best one possible. And if we remember back before Lightning, there was a lot of like absolutely garbage connectors and protocols out there. So it was a blessing when they came out and encrypted it and made it so you had to get certified because it actually worked kind of like as we now kind of experience. You plug it in and like everything works great. So I think that the intention there is to make a good user experience. So you love your iPhone, not to make the revenue. But it's fun to talk about conspiracy theories.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm into it.
What headphones do you have there, Nick?
Funny you should ask. These are Grados.
Okay.
It's a company in Brooklyn. And it's actually cool. The housings are wood from old tanning drums. And the headband is Cordovan.
Dude, yeah. Wow.
Is that like
a limited edition for you guys?
Yeah, I made two different sets. Like this one has, it's an African wood called Bolando. And then I made one out of Purple Heart too, because we have drums out of that. And these sound way better for whatever reason. So I'm going to work with the people over at Grado, and we're going to do I don't know, 25 of these or whatever. And sell them.
How fun.
Pre-made and or pre-sale rather, because they're going to be quite fancy.
Yeah,
I mean they're fancy anyway, and then like the additional material inputs just like of the wood. I mean you don't get like a podcast, doesn't really, you don't get like the full sound, but
no,
if you plug it into amp and listen to lossless stuff, if they sound really good.
Nice. Are you into like the title? What's your lossless service?
I don't have anything beyond just like the Apple Music and making sure I'm plugged in and using the, or paying attention to what the bit rates are. But which do you listen to something?
I don't, but my buddy is quite into it. Yeah. And, I'm toying with it, and, I'm just sort of looking at the total cost of ownership. Getting into audiophile stuff is just a dark hole.
Yeah. I have these, and then I have like an amp, like a DAC amp. That's like,
okay. Yeah. Yeah. You're down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, it looks nice. It sits on my desk. I'll send you a link to what I've.
Send me a link.
My setup. It's very concise, but also fancy.
It looks nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Concise, but fancy is like your whole.
That's my whole.
Your whole life. I mean, there's some. I came in on like the last sentence of your conversation, but I think that's, I always, when we were talking about the patina on leather, I always think about, and with the music stuff I do, most things I do, I try to do nothing. Like just get out of the way, let the steak be a steak and don't cover it in cheese whiz.
Depends on the steak.
I mean, I like cheese whiz, but I don't want it on my,
you
like.
You just alienated the entire Philadelphia audience.
Oh, yeah. Brian, I wanted to ask you about your design process. Maybe we can start with that Apple Watch you're talking about. When you were designing a strap for the Apple Watch, how do you differentiate a watch strap? Because at the end of the day, like when I make belts, it's like, it's a belt. You can't really do that much, but how do you view your design process of something like that?
Like, I think that kind of get out of the way and make the steak for sure. But also, like, there's a ways to make, like, the steak even more steaky. I think that's sort of like what we try to do in certain ways, but there's like harder ways to make like a watch band. And then there's like easier ways. Like you can make one in your garage. So you can just cut out a piece of leather, just like chop it, turn it, stitch the top with the buckle is and punch some holes. And like, you got a watch band. And that's like a very true form leather watch band. Like totally. Like if you're looking for the truest leather experience, like that's the way to go. Right. I mean, you make great ones, right? It's like Cordovan, Ashland leather, like, you know, whatever. Perfect. But you can do it. You can kind of take it a little bit further. And so what we have is like access to like complex manufacturing. And so we're like, okay, let's use that and like make it like the kind of a different whole perspective on it and make it also the leatheriest of leather. So there's multiple fillers on the inside and they give different flex characteristics to it. And then the leather, instead of being sewn around the corner, we didn't want the sewing strip. So it's like the process of removal. It's like, well, how do we remove the stitching? We don't want the stitching. The stitching is like a distraction. So you turn it over, you turn it over and glue it. Okay. Well, I don't want that glue mark on the underside to be visible. I want it to be like completely abstracted. It's just an abstracted piece of leather, just the most leather. It looks like just a single piece of leather. Okay, well, if you do that, you actually see the cut lines along the side. Well, I don't want to see the inside of the leather. I want to see the outside. I bought four wing. I want it all the way around on the front and the back. Okay, so you skive it super thin on the sides and you turn the edges. A lot of people will just cut it and then paint it along the sides. That's what like Hermes and I mean a lot of people do is the cut. So we do a turned edge. So it's actually goes along the side and turned down. Like, okay, it's not very durable. Okay. Well, how do we make it more durable? Well, what glue do we source from Italy? And, you know, how do we get that? And so with a combination of the fillers and the turned edges and everything, it just becomes sort of like a fairly simple looking object. And like, I dare you to reproduce it. You know, yeah. And we get people copying us all the time now where they copy the form, the aesthetic, and they use a lot of the same like lugs and the same buckles and, you know, almost use the same branding even. And people are say like, how do you compete? And it's like, well, it's tough when you're comparing a rendering online one-to-one, but when you actually get the product in person and you see it, it's very obvious which one had the care and the attention and which one didn't, and they don't get recommended on the reviews online. You might get conned here and there, but like it's a very different product. So I think that's our thing, is like that charger you held up, you could make that looks basically the same online with a plastic base and, you know, plastic painted material and a few other like lacking details. And when you finally got it in your house and held it in your hand, you'd be like, cheap crap. Yeah, I don't know. But that's the Nomad touch. And the people that kind of get that know is that we've gone a little bit loony bin on it. And it's special. And I dare you to copy it because it's kind of insane. So that's kind of our secret sauce, is well, the over the top.
I mean, the chicken and egg question, though, it sounds like you're focusing this a lot from the production methodology of like how these things are made. But when you first envisioned a watch strap, how do you draw inspiration from existing products and try to just modify them to your taste? Or, you know, where's the...
I never was a watch guy or anything. So it was just sort of like, well, we're going to make a leather watch band. Like, well, what's like the leatheriest of leathery watch bands? And what does that mean? And at first we started with stitching, like the pillowed kind of design where it's like pillowed, and we still make that called the traditional band. And then I was like, well, what's like more leathery than that? And it's like, well, no stitching, like, well, you know, no edge paint, like, you know. So it's sort of like it's you know, not to be annoying, but like the process, design is a process of reduction, you know.
Very annoying.
Yeah, very annoying.
I mean, it sounds more like you have a philosophy of I want in this product, I want leather. That's my North Star. What am I going to do to make it the most leather? I think that makes sense.
Where yeah. you start at a place where it's like, okay, I want the band that's the stitching around the edges, and then the, you know, that's filled with the either leather or some sort of composite. And like, that's what people are used to seeing. And then you're like, well, that's not really that interesting. And also maybe doesn't fit the aesthetic of the product that's going on. So then you go down the road and you start making it better and improving on it. So
there's a lot of minor improvements. Like yeah. I think that nothing kind of stops at Nomad. It's always like a slight bit better, a slight bit better, a slight bit better, a slight bit better. We're super excited that we're introducing like a new subtle glue or like a slightly different skiving process because we upgraded the machine to go, you know, 2 thou thinner or something. And it's like, we know it's better. And so you look back and compare, but I don't know if everyone's doing that. And so that's what's kind of the fun of it is like knowing that we're on generation internally, like generation 7 of what appears to be the same product. And we're like, we're just proud of it. Yeah. Design philosophy, man. I don't know. I don't know if I could write it down.
No, I'm not. Yeah. I'm not necessarily interested in a dissertation, but just like thought process of like what you already gave. I like that. And the cool. other thing you mentioned earlier was details. Do you design details or do you think it is more like these details are in terms of they come about because of functionality or like we were talking about, you want the mass of this base, is it called the base station? The charging station, you want that mass to be a certain thing, so that's a detail. You I guess, how do you
view mass details? That was a driving part about like the mass did need to be heavy. You can make it lighter, and when you pull the phone off, like it lifts the charger up.
Yep.
So like it's nicer if it's heavier. Otherwise, you have to do this like kind of weird like rotation thing to take it off. So you can totally make it lighter. It's not as cool, but I think that more importantly, there's just, I mean, the annoying repeatable thing is like, you know, you go to a whatever, you know, non-German car and the door closes and it sounds like crap. And you go to a German, you know, nice German car and the door closes and it sounds great. It's because someone over there cares a shit ton, spent 15 years futzing around on it and perfecting it. And it matters to them at a fundamental core level that is what is important. The sound, the feel, all those like intangible things matter. And so I think that you need someone that's a little neurotic and OCD to just care about all the little things. And I think that a lot of people think design is purely like form or function, but there's also like auditory and like textures and smells, you know, obviously in Horween's case, but auditory is super important too. Like how do you touch it and feel like, does your keyboard sound nice? Does your, when you're moving your sliders and your soundboard, does it sound crunchy or does it sound glassy? Like that's an important input. Yeah.
I mean the clicky keyboard, I actually just clicked it. It's actually a problem for this show because it's like it gets a little loud.
I have a mechanical keyboard too. That, speaking of weights, has like a big brass weight in it. That's like weighs like a pound. So like it's silly, but I can't talk on the phone and type, especially with my wife. She's like, "Will you stop working and just talk to me for a second?" Because the keys are so loud.
Yeah.
But yeah, the tactile. Yeah. I think the tactile thing, especially. Like I think the car door is a great example because if you have like this fancy German car and then you close the door and it sounds like you're, you know, zipping a plastic bag or whatever, I mean, that totally ruins the whole experience. So you have to pay attention to all of those little things to make the big overall thing, you know, feel right and make the experience correct for what you.
Yeah. Expect. And it doesn't even necessarily make it more or less expensive to make. That's what's wild. Like it may probably makes it a little bit more expensive, but it's just about tuning all the details into being something that comes together as being good. Like in our process of making prototypes and stuff, like they don't just come out of like the lab as like what they are now. Like there's periods in there where they feel cheap. Like Nomad products absolutely feel cheap. And then it's a exercise in turning it into what we call like a nomad product. Is it a nomad product or not? And it's like tweaking this, adding some foam, adding a little bit of weight, adding some silicone beading, adding a little like in the watch bands, we have leather and then we have the filler materials, and the fillers, like playing with them. Like, is it like this high density one? Is it this lower density one? Is it a combination? Like all these little things. And it goes from like this, like little, like blip, 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 and it kind of flips like chintzy to like, ooh, ooh, you know, and it's like, there it is. And same thing with the durometer of the plastic, like on our plastic watch bands. The FKM ones, it's like, if it's slightly too stiff, it just feels like this. If it's too thin, it kind of bounces around. And if it's just right, it's like this nice tuned suspension on a car. And so, yeah.
That's really
what you said. You said FKM. Is that what you said?
Yeah. It's a fluoroelastomer. I don't know. It's a mystery.
Which strap is that?
Sport bands and the rugged bands.
I think it's an interesting thing what you're describing. Do you guys actually have a lab spec sheet for how much flex there should be or should not be in that watch band? Just as a weird side question here.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So I prefer it to be a little more human, where it's like you kind of know when it's quality and you try to get the factory and everyone like up to speed on what that means. But as we've gotten bigger, kind of the next point is you kind of need to define things in a very like precise and technical way. And so it's been a bit of a challenge for me personally. That's where my team is better than me at this, is defining those in terms of like actual like repeatable tests to define like the actual prescribed thing. Also with dealing with leather, all these like very precise engineering documents about a very imprecise, you know, art. It's kind of annoying. And I wish things were a bit more arty, but when you're dealing with that scale, you do need to have the definition. So yeah, we literally have like a test where it's like you hold it in there and you flex it and you count how many times it bobbles until it stops. And that, you know, defines the, if it's good or not.
I mean, that's a funny test, but I think that would work. Yeah. Right.
I mean, I think that's an interesting place that where you're at, where you're taking this thing that's different every single time. And then you're inserting it into this very technical process and application.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's impressive to me because you're taking, I mean, and I just know the leather part of it. I'm sure that there's with plastics and hardware and fillers and glues, it's the same, but you're taking something that is what it is. And then you're manipulating it so that it does what you want it to do, which is what everybody does. But when you're taking a piece of leather and then thinning it down as much as
we get it down to like paper thin, not just on the sides and stuff, but yeah, it's crazy.
And then you have to control it and making sure it's totally flat and it stays put, and it's not easy.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun. I think when you were describing,
my favorite part.
You were describing the feel of the thing, of the strap. It reminds me of trying to describe to people the body or like the hand feel of Chrome Excel, pick any leather, where it has this sort of roundness, but it wants to snap back to your hand. That's the best way I can describe it. You can measure this, it's called a temper, on a temper gauge, which is like a, I don't know how to describe it. It looks like a U shape that sort of clamps down on the leather. It has an aperture in it with a needle that comes down, and it measures how far that needle can press into the leather before it stops flexing. So the weird thing about that test is it still doesn't give you the hand feel. I can say, hey, I've got a 2 millimeter temper on this. Like that 2 millimeter in Chrome Excel is going to feel different than a 2 millimeter on Latigo. So you can, my only point here is that I get frustrated.
No, there's certain things you just can't really define. Yeah. You gotta hold it and touch it. And like, I don't know how the internet's going to handle that, but like if we're buying all this stuff online, like we're going to have some way to communicate some of these things, because otherwise we're just going to trend towards crappier and crappier stuff.
Well, yeah, that's my concern. And you can't make a spec sheet for like how pleasant something feels to you. There is some subjectivity to it also. And then if you're designing, and this is where my my conclusion is that I think the world has, in the last couple decades, has designed products to spec sheets, which it sounds like you're not necessarily doing. Like you're sort of doing this nice gray area in between.
Yeah, I'm like doing it to feel, but then like making the kind of product engineers like figure out how to quantify that, mm-hmm. versus the other way, which is normally spec sheet first, and then design kind of gets to deal with it.
I mean, yeah. We're just going to homogenize the world into spec sheet products if it continues. But I see some stuff coming back the other direction.
There's plenty of good stuff out there. There's plenty of people that are doing good stuff. Actually, it's a bit of an art. And like, frankly, I think what it is requiring is a mass of like a million people to kind of become sort of artisans again, like in a way. Like, and that's what I am seeing, actually. I mean, like, we do everything in China, like, and you can have your spec sheet factories, but you can also have like factories that are quite good and passionate and cool and, you know, very nice, like great people. And they're really doing it. They've got all these, their own internal tricks and processes and cares, and they're excited and they come to you with all these amazing, new things that they've been thinking about. And so that's a really exciting development. So you can do things, yeah, at scale, but you can also do it with like some kind of human element too. Like, yes, you do need some spec sheets. Yes. But there's hope, guys. There's hope.
Take that, ChatGPT. Yeah. Not today, ChatGPT. Yeah, I think that the you can kind of boil it down to, at least from a factory side, like an acceptable range. And color is the easiest example. It can be a little bit lighter or a little bit darker and still be acceptable. But the more specific and the more exacting you make that standard, I mean, it's harder on some people and easier on others. But then any deviation from that becomes a problem from, you know, the factory on down to the customer, because they're not expecting anything different anymore.
I think that, I mean, I spent a lot of time in China. And I actually do love American made, but I do appreciate China a lot too, culturally. And I think a lot of it came down to in the last 30 years, the first 20 of those years, like the 90s and early 2000s, like they were making all of our stuff, but they were incredibly impoverished and like we're not consumers. So they were like not sure what the heck we all wanted, right? So we needed spec sheets because they didn't really get it. They were like, we're buying really cheap, like nothing, or not buying really much at all. But now they're like quite wealthy and they're all consumers. Like the factory workers and everyone like knows about jeans and materials and leather bags and everything. And they know what's nice and what's not nice. And so what's nice is to be able to talk to them in terms of, do you think it's nice? And they're like, yes or no, because they know, and they are consuming and they drive electric cars and that it's like a reasonable conversation. So I think the fact that they are wealthier and consuming and participating at the same kind of way we are is that there's a much more human, again, kind of, we're on the same footing, again, when we talk product. So
I think that's an important thing to, because I think that there's a sort of like a legacy perception that made in China means cheap.
It's a brand.
Yeah.
It was a brand.
Yeah. And I don't think that's, I mean, we've talked to other people about this too. I don't think that's the case. I mean, it can still be the case. You can get something that's made poorly from any country. It doesn't need to be.
Absolutely. You can get something poorly made.
But I think you can get good stuff. You can get good stuff from everywhere at this point too. I think that to say, you know, from a blanket standpoint, that something that's made in a certain place isn't, make that sort of disqualifies it from being good is ridiculous.
It's pretty ridiculous. It really doesn't matter how much care the brand has for the thing. Like if they choose to make it here, great, but they better care a lot. Otherwise it's going to look like some Home Depot plumbing, you know, whack product that's like vacuum molded, you know, and it's just crap. But if they care a lot, like you can do incredible things. If it's overseas, if it's in Germany, if it's in the Ukraine, like wherever, you can do great stuff. But it's ultimately the responsibility of the brand to give a shit about making nice stuff or not.
Right. I mean, our past podcast guest, Wyatt from Grantstone, made the point, like, you can make great stuff in the United States. You can make great stuff in China. You can make crap stuff in both countries. And it's not necessarily about the place, because geography is irrelevant. But I still, to this day, I get comments on a YouTube video I put out with Wyatt from Grantstone criticizing me for promoting a Chinese brand. And I think it's very, I still find it to be strange. It's like, what do you want me to, just don't buy it, dude. Like, why do you feel the need to leave a comment about this? Just don't buy it.
I think people should travel more, travel to China, read some history, like have some empathy. Like, they're people too. Like, what's wrong with them getting a little bit of success? Like, come on.
Now I'll tell you this, Wyatt and his factory in Xiamen make a very nice boot. They also use, here's a good segue, they also use different types of leather, not just Nick's leather. And I got an email from Nomad 6 months ago, maybe more. Time is flying. It was like, hey, don't worry, Horween fans. I think it was something like that was the subject. And in the body it said, hey, we're also using this other leather called Eco. What's the story there, Brian? What's going on with Horween and Eco? Are you still carrying Horween stuff?
So basically, like there just is like a not everyone wants it to go crazy patina in the first 15 minutes.
By the way, I just realized I'm pronouncing it crazy wrong. It's Echo, right?
That's correct.
Echo. I'm the worst. I'm glad that we had to call me out on that. Okay, sorry.
We're going to see how long you were going to go.
Yeah, so it's tricky. It's not everyone wants it to patina in the first 5 seconds. And frankly, like there are like, you know, supply chain stuff where you do want it made faster and like a bit more mass production. Like it doesn't have to be crap. It's still is good. It's still patinas, but it's just not quite Horween. And I think that like maybe, you know, maybe it's good for Horween to be its own, you know, special rarefied thing. That's what's kind of amazing about it. Like, and so what we're going to have is we're always going to have the Horween as our top tier. It's our top tier. It's our main seller still, actually. It's what people really, really, our fans really want. But like, there's also people that want it, like truthfully want it to like not patina as quick. And I think that's okay. It's not covered in plastic. It's not, you're not experiencing fake crap leather. It's still Danish, nice ass leather. Excuse my words here. It just has a different characteristic. It just breaks in slower and it looks a little bit more perfect with their iPhone longer. So it's kind of like what we're trying to say is like one is not necessarily like worse than the other, but Horween is more of this. If you're looking for this extreme thing, like this is it. But if you're looking for this, then like this is it. They're just two different things you're looking for.
Your response, Nick. So you have 2 minutes respond. Yeah,
no, I think it makes perfect sense. I mean, we're in a niche where we're at. And I think that, you know, there's a reason that we're our size and Echo's size. I mean, Echo's a giant company. They're a lot bigger than we are. Because it is a different product. It's more consistent. They can make stuff more consistent. They can deliver more. I've never ordered leather from them, but I don't know what their lead times are. But you know, ours can get longer because of our process. So I think it makes total sense. I mean, there's a reason there are different options out there. And you know, I don't necessarily want when I get something that's leather for it to be scratched and changing the first day either. Mm-hmm. But I've got a little bit of a different lens on things. So,
yeah. No, it just really depends on like, I personally will rock the Horween, right? That's like, that's what I'm going to rock. But yeah, I think that there's a difference. And frankly, we're experimenting. We're not sure.
Hmm. There is this interesting thing where you were saying Horween is this and Echo, not Eco, is this, is that.
It's just different.
Well, I mean, even within the Horween leathers themselves, I had a call yesterday, a customer called me and basically his package was lost in the mail and he was just like impressed that I answered the phone. And he's like, I ordered a Dublin wallet and because you've been so nice to me, you know, If you are to send me a replacement, I want to upgrade my order. I want to pay more money, and I want to buy a Shell Cordovan piece. And I said, okay, well, if you want to do that, great. But you don't need to do all that. You don't need to spend extra money here. I just want you to have your wallet. And he's like, well, I don't really understand the difference. Like, it is a lot more expensive. And I was like, stop right there. Like, just take your Dublin wallet, because that's an amazing leather. Like, just,
yeah, Dublin. We use Dublin. It's amazing.
And but he's comparing it to Cordovan. They're both, I think part of the confusion is that, which is again why I started the whole brand of Ashland, is like, I didn't know that you could make different leather tannages. I thought leather was one thing. It was singularly brown. It was like everything was the same, and I didn't realize you could do so much with it. And
there's a lot of browns, by the way. It's insanely hard to quantify.
I mean, brown's cool too. I'm wearing brown right now. This happens to be natural chrome XL, but it's darkened up a bit. So there's all to be said is, all I'm trying to say is that leather is sort of a language. And in the case with Horween, there's often a future in that material that you can't see now, but a year from now, it's going to transform and sort of change to your style for many of their products. And it's not every Horween leather either. So that's where the confusion comes in for me. And I think a lot of people, and when you're saying like, we got the Echo stuff and we got the Horween stuff, the only thing there's to be said is they're different.
Right? Well, they're just different.
Inside our company, there's a range. And then inside Echo, there's a range. And then among all the tanneries, there's a range too. So it's just, you have to pick where,
the extreme kind of patina side of Echo, for example.
Right.
Like they're like, yeah, sure. And we're like,
yeah. Nobody buys this stuff.
Yeah, but it would be on the other extreme side of Horween. Right. And so I think there's just like an expertise. And I mean, they're also like incredibly environmentally efficient. They're a Danish company. They're also cool. I mean, they're like a designer driven whole thing where they have all these like kind of interesting whole other approach, where Horween is more of a traditional driven kind of whole thing. And so, frankly, like we live in a universe of iPhone, which, we're bringing in the traditional values of Horween and then the kind of designer driven values of Echo. It's kind of I think it's okay. It's a line we're walking. We'll find out if it's a good idea or not. But
it seems to make sense from where I'm
that's what we're trying to do.
Well, yeah. I often get asked like, what's the best leather? And it's an impossible.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of reminds me of what you were talking about.
Like Japanese craftsmen, right? Like, I don't know. He makes like one piece a year.
Maybe,
like,
yeah. I mean, but I think the real answer is there is no best. It's kind of like your experience when you're designing your watch band. It's like, I need it to flex this much and not that much. There is a lot of subjectivity to it and how you feel about the thing. Like, how does it smell? Aesthetic characteristics.
Oh, like I know, like people are, would like some people on this are probably like, you put fillers in and glues, like you sacrilegious, and like, and it's like, yes, then you should go to Ashland and get one of his. Cause like, that's like what he does best.
It's different.
Right? Yeah. It's different. And that's like, that's what that is. And then like, if you're not looking for that, like that's what this is. And there's no like best. Unless it's Shell Cordovan, then it is the best.
I don't know. It's even there, like
it's not for everybody.
It's a different thing. Like we've done some limited editions and people are quite confused because they're like, hey, my like $300 wallet is like scratching and like it's like looking weird. And you're like, trust me, hang on. Yeah.
Now you're describing my day to day life, Brian.
Yeah.
Hey, have you ever thought about making stuff in the United States?
We did actually. We went, if you remember back, we actually looked at a factory with you, I think like 8 years ago.
Yeah, I tried to hook you up.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, I'm good.
I think that we are interested. We are interested. Frankly, like the amount of actual tooling and like stuff that we're doing is like a bit tricky, because it would mean like often we're doing like molded EVA and injection molding and magnets and magnetization machines where we actually put raw metal in and then we actually make a jig and magnetize it and the heat presses and the glue. It's just like it's a bit much. So it would be possible, but it would be, frankly, it'd be a technology transfer. Like it'd be a lot of lift. We'd have to do a lot of educating.
Yeah. I guess the other question is, why would you even want to make things in the United States?
I think purely for marketing, just nostalgia. I mean, I think it's totally fine to be globalized. Like,
if I could make you your exact products in Santa Barbara, or where would you say you're in Ventura?
If you could make them in my warehouse,
that would
be sick.
So you would do that, right? So obviously logistics would be a nice reason. Yeah.
No, I think I would. I kind of wax nostalgic about having the office upstairs and then going downstairs to the factory floor, and like that would be a really, really cool thing. And I really would like that. But we use so many different processes at this point. You know, we're doing vapor deposited PVD coatings on our titanium, and we don't just do leather like at all. Like, you know, we're in the business of making plastic cases, and our cases themselves are complicated. They have metal buttons and they have multiple materials and microfibers. So we would need literally like 1,000 machines if we were going to like in-house it. So I think that what people kind of don't quite realize is it really takes like a village. Like, it takes a clustering of a ton of different processes to kind of be a manufacturing center. Like frankly, we looked at like the Philippines and other places, and like they can do like one process. I went to Pakistan, I went to Bangladesh, a bunch of places, and they can do sewn wallets. You can take a wallet, cut it out, and sew it together, but you can't do the heat pressing, the injection molding, all the kind of details that go into it. And so that's where you need a place where all those processes are all in the same city.
Yeah.
So some of them exist here for sure, but they're often in like aerospace. Like, America can make great shit, but it's often aerospace or medical grade.
The big ticket stuff or extra big ticket.
You said the really high precision stuff, the unnecessarily high precision stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's the vapor deposited titanium? I think you skimmed over that. What does that even mean?
So you like our steels and as well, all the metal stuff we do, it's called PVD, particle vapor deposition. And so you take your raw part, you put it in like an argon gas chamber, and then it's cool. It uses electricity, heats up, turns into a purple plasma, spins it around, and then it injects into that gas cloud a little bit of another gas that coats the material, the metal, and makes a super hard coating on it and adds the color. So you can do like a basic anodization. You can get really good anodization for sure, but that's really for aluminum. So to get a black metal or a black titanium, PVD is kind of like one of the gold standards of getting a really good hard dark finish on it. Obviously, titanium is naturally silver, so if you want to colorize it, you have to do some sort of advanced process.
Is it penetrating the surface of the?
No. Yeah, there's nothing really that does that. Like, that's like, there's like black oxides, but that you give up a lot of characteristics and, you know, rust resistance and scratch resistance there. We choose PVD. It's kind of like jewelry grade. And then you can add an additional, like, it's called DLC. And I'm honestly a little bit inept to say what it is, but it's sort of like a little carbon coating that goes on top of that to increase the hardness. So hardness is scratch resistance. So it actually stays in the tank for like 6 hours and slowly deposits it on there and grows the little carbon, like a carbon film on the surface. And it makes it harder and harder and harder, because titanium and steel, though hard, still scratch, fairly easily. And ideally, those don't scratch. Like, we want our leathers to scratch, but we don't love our leather or metals to scratch. That looks weird.
I had a completely different picture in my mind of that process. Just like, I was like picturing this little chamber with like a purple cloud, and you, like, something happens and then it comes out and it's a different color like 2 minutes later. It's like a magic trick, but that sounds a lot more like an involved process.
That's awesome.
It's very technical. It's like you view in through a vacuum like window. It's like, look, there's a submarine hole and there's a whole panel over here and there's a bunch of big gas cylinders and they're all plumbed in and it's timing, you know, when it's sending it in and you're controlling the heat and the vacuum level. It's very cool. And I think that's the stuff that I find like really quite like interesting and exciting to be able to use and not be limited by. And that's becoming fairly commonplace, like not commonplace, but like it's fairly accessible over there.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I think that's an example. I think where if you were to try to make something in a different place, like that's just one of 1,000 machines that you would need. And like,
I need a whole PVD, like expert technician center machine. And that's just to put the coating on it. That's not any of the other milling or, you know, all the other processes. And right. We do like, for example, we do metal injection molding, which I've talked to people in other countries and whatever. And they're like, that's mystery science level stuff. And so what that is,
it's like our casting, lug, but different.
Yeah, this is crazy. So our lugs that are on your, I think you're using our lug still, right?
Yeah. Oh. I was going to say, you reminded me that I need to reorder some of these. I think the buckles and the lugs we order from you guys.
Sweet. Yeah. And so they're actually, it's a metal slurry in a plastic. And so it's like, I don't know, I forget what the percentage is, but it's like 65% metal and like 35% plastic. And you inject it into a part. So that lug on the Apple Watch, and it's like 30% bigger. So it comes out as like this kind of clown, funny, big part. That's like a heavy weighted plastic. And so that's the injection part. And then you put it in an oven that's extremely well controlled. Sometimes they're microwave based instead of oven or temperature, whatever. Conductive based, and it evaporates out the plastic, and then the metal sinters together, and you take it out at the exact right time, and it's shrunken down that 30% into a solid metal piece that's exactly the right size.
Wow, they know the rate at which it shrinks?
Extremely precisely. It's incredibly precise, and it's a very high cosmetic finish. So anything that's like, yeah, so our lugs are metal injection molded. It's not wow. like CNC stuff. It's cool.
Well, imagine a world that you don't need to die cast stuff. I mean, is it a slow process to do
it's that? Slow and expensive.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's incredibly precise. We're die casting. It's a lower grade material. Like we can do like 400 grade stainless steels. Like we do 300 grade, but you can do 400 grade. You can do really, really, really nice stuff at incredibly high tolerances and really nice finishes, where die cast is just never going to have unless you like investment casting, but that's really slow also, but you're never really going to get like a really super high tolerance part. So it's an amazing tech that it's an enabling tech to do a lot of these cool things.
Makes me feel like you should make watch, like actual, you know, like watch parts.
What?
We're making all of our stuff at like Swish Watchmakers. Yeah. So, yeah.
What kind of plastic is used in that? I mean, when you said that, I was like, well, how do you get the plastic the metal where you need it to be? And it makes sense that you're carrying it. It's being carried by something with a different melting point
You don't actually know what the plastic is. That's a good question.
Yeah, because it's in there to serve a purpose, and then it's not in there anymore. It's gone.
Yeah, it's like a PhD grade whole thing that was developed, you know, and then now when we first started doing it, it was like really rare, and it was like, holy shit, you're doing MIMing. It's called MIMing, metal injection molding, and it was like, holy crap, that's MIMed. Like, wow, I've only read about that on the internet. Wow. And so now, like, titanium MIMing is sort of in that kind of rarefied space. Like, we haven't really found someone that really does titanium MIMing yet. It'll eventually get there. But that's sort of the fun playground of all this, is like getting to do these kind of wild, kind of cool processes.
Well, I'm getting the sense that this might be a source of new inspiration for future products. So you got some stuff in mind from the MIMing?
Yeah. MIMing's great. It just can't do very large parts. So the shrinkage thing doesn't work great for big stuff. But Yeah, I mean, we have a number of, well, we have something really cool for the Apple Watch coming out in a MIM steel. It's a case for the Apple Watch.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know that there's some, well, maybe we'll delete this stuff, by the way. There's some trade secrets you probably can't speak about, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, good luck copying it.
No, I mean, like when with regards to Apple, I don't know if, well, actually, maybe we can, tell me if we should not talk about this, but something that Nick and I were discussing was, how do you stay on trend with these technology accessories that are so, you know, of tomorrow, and then also use a material, I don't know how long it takes to get from Echo, but a material from Nick might take several months to get that material in hand. How are you staying on trend with these new tech things? I'm assuming they give you some sort of insider program. What is that? No,
it's a new insider program. It's just pure cowboy risky craziness.
They don't tell you anything.
Nothing. I'm reading the same basic stuff that you guys are on the internet.
Just going on Mac rumors or whatever.
Basically, we're all operating off of essentially Mac rumors. Like, we might get the rumor 2 days beforehand, or in a slightly bit more detail, but it's coming essentially from the same rumor. And then we have to filter through which rumors on Mac rumors are. It's tricky because there's rumors and then there's leaks. So a rumor might be Nick, you know, dorking out, drinking a bunch of coffee at midnight, making up a render of what the new iPhone's going to look like. And that's
just like,
that. Yeah, he would totally do that.
I mean, it's crazy. Like, that is what some people do. And they've made little careers out of doing that. And it drives blog traffic, you know, to them. And they come out with the new iPhone, and it's like artist rendering. And you're like, okay, filter. That's like just someone's interpretation of what it could be. And I think that's confusing to people. It's even confusing to people at Nomad. Like, did you see the latest rumor? And I'm like, dude, no, that's someone's imagination. That's not a leak. And then there's a leak, which is, you know, it actually, we got a photo from the source and we believe it's a real leak.
All right. Unless you had any more questions, I want to move on to favorites, Nick.
I don't know. I did have a question and I don't know how, so maybe edit this out or figure out. I'll ask it and then figure out how to ask it again, but I heard, I mean, I've heard.
This is
the biggest.
This is another caveat. Weird conspiracy theory thing that
you. No, I mean, because you hear things in and around the industry and you wonder, it's very, I mean, even though there are a lot of companies, it still feels like a small industry, and it's very, I don't know if other industries are this way, but it can be kind of gossipy at times. Which is whatever, it is what it is. But
so let me gossip for you right now.
Yeah. No, you hear about big companies coming, getting into leather and then getting out of leather. And I just didn't know if there was anything, if you'd heard anything about that. I'm not going to name any company names, but I didn't know if you'd heard anything about that, because people are always, they're developing different synthetics and composites and the different.
Oh, yeah. Everyone wants to get into the composites, but they're not as cool.
No, they're not. They're not as good. Yeah. They're still not as good. I mean, to the point of the headsets. I mean, someday maybe, but it's not there yet.
Do you see a future of leather in the world, Brian? Is maybe that's what you're asking me.
I don't think it should be called leather. That's what I get annoyed when they call it vegan leather. I'm like, yes. No, it's not leather.
Well, the FTC says you actually can't.
So we need the leather working group to trademark what you can't call oat milk anymore. It's an oat beverage, right? It's not milk.
That's right.
The milk lobby got together and fought that. Like, it's not leather anymore. It's something else. And that's cool. It's something else. It's another material. It's not leather.
Yeah.
It's all right.
So do you see a future for leather, though?
I do. I think that if done ethically, frankly, I went to Pakistan and saw the leather being made there. It's it's a problem. It's really polluting. It's quite bad. It's making a bad reputation for leather. Not good. Definitely need cleanup. Work on it, Pakistan. Work on it. But the way that Hormeen and Echo makes it, it's totally responsible. And it's a cool leather. It's a cool material. Like, we don't need everything to be like super boring. Like, I think we can figure out as a society here to, that we can have our cake and eat it too. We can have our leather and it's okay.
All right, Brian, I'm going to move on to favorites. What are you into these days that's perhaps not orc related? We used to talk a lot about like, hey, what's your favorite book or your TV show? But I think framing it is more of like, what relaxes you or what do you like to do outside of work?
Ooh, I am remodeling a kitchen in our house, and I've adopted a love of German power tools.
Whoa.
Are you doing the remodeling?
Yeah.
Nice.
Nick's going to need some help, some tips.
Can you... It's a different story. Yeah. So tell us about, so German power tools, is there like a brand or a specific tool that you're...
Yeah. There's a couple, you get a little bit of a, like a cult around it. It's not that different than like the Horween kind of obsession thing, but it's Festool.
Can you spell that please?
Festool.
I've heard of it.
I'm going to look it up.
Yeah. And it's like, it's sort of like the Apple or whatever the Horween. It's like they give a shit and like, you pay for it, definitely. But like, it's quite a satisfying whole experience. It's sort of that like fancy but minimal kind of whole kind of philosophy, Nick, like very much there. And yeah. So I just finished installing the cabinets yesterday, doing the butcher block later today. And yeah, it's, I'm literally sitting next to some of the pieces that are drying right now, but you know,
ooh, it looks good.
Yeah. So it's been something that's been really fun because everything I'm doing is sort of at work is like the complete opposite. Like I'm implementing an ERP, NetSuite.
Oh, that sounds fun.
It's an accounting and inventory whole platform, and it's one side of the brain. It's actually is a lot of fun. It's just a totally different side of things, right? And then this is like the super physical kind of reality world.
Which is, yeah, I get a lot of people that interact with me that are, you know, software engineers, and they come to me because they're interested in the leather because they want to do stuff with their hands, which I think is pretty neat. So maybe it's a similar experience.
It's extremely similar. It's like the yin to the yang, like doing something very physical and you know, three-dimensional and requiring honestly mulling over of like how to do things and kind of letting my brain kind of think about how to like install cabinets and non-square walls and that is like a nice refreshing kind of thought versus like accounting lists and stuff there, which is also cool actually. I'm not hating on it. It's just a different whole thing.
Yeah, I get you. I know what Nick's doing right now is he's feverishly searching for what his favorite
is. I'm looking at Festool and I'm going down the rabbit hole already.
Are you ready? Are you ready to share, Nick, or would you like me?
Jackson Life.
Go Corbett. Yeah, I mean, it's a mobile dust extractor, which I think is just
you could use that at the tannery,
which is just a vacuum.
It's a $700 vacuum.
No, this one's $985. It looks like this looks like it's like got some very specific like drywall.
That one has like some extra parts. I know exactly what you're talking about. I actually have basically the same one, but it's quite a rabbit hole. But like I have I'm doing the remodel, and I have my wood shop, whatever is basically just a carport, and like built the whole cabinets with almost no dust. I swept up like once.
Wow. Nice. Sort of.
So it like is a pretty amazing way to work. You can basically do it like in your living room. If you want to. I mean, it makes a little bit of dust, but it's really quite little. So it's a totally different like woodworking experience.
Let's check it out.
Yeah, you need Nick's gonna do some work.
I'm sorry, Nick. You've lost a lot of money now.
I don't. This is a conversation for another day, I think. Yeah.
All right, I'm so excited to share.
Go ahead. I'll go after you.
I'm really into Michael Jordan right now. Are you a Jordan fan though?
Or not? I do. He pops up on my YouTube feed a lot, and I'm always like, I'm kind of impressed.
I know. I grew up. You know, we are in Chicago, so we grew up Bulls fans. And then in the pandemic, we had the documentary come out on Netflix. Actually, it was on ESPN, I think, first, The Last Dance. And I watched it when it came out. I was like, this is amazing. I forgot how awesome Michael Jordan is and how awesome Scottie Pippen is and how awesome Dennis Rodman was. And
yeah,
it was fun nostalgia there. But also, I watched it again like this year, like last month. And it was, I think there's a deeper level to the fun nostalgia, which is just like how damn awesome Michael Jordan was. And then I would sit at night just like, what am I going to look at on YouTube tonight? And I would look up like best Michael Jordan moments of all time.
Yeah.
And the guy was, apparently he was kind of a jerk to his teammates and other people.
That's what I've kind of realized. And I kind of liked that. I kind of liked that he was kind of a,
he was a fire starter. Yeah. I mean,
he's a hard ass. He like cared a lot about winning in the game so much that like anyone that was not perfect, like he
grilled him.
I thought I didn't really realize it because he's kind of polished, right, in this whole like marketing thing that we kind of got of Jordan. And then you kind of get the clips and like people are, you know, now on YouTube and YouTube Shorts especially kind of sharing little clips about him. That's where I'm getting it. And it's like,
dude was crazy, man.
Not fucking around. It was it's awesome.
Like I have to be that good.
I mean, he inspired me to like get a basketball. In my adult age. I mean, when I was a kid, like everybody was playing basketball in Chicago because they're all Bulls fans. But that led to now. I was talking to my buddy Justin, who will never listen to this, but he's into sneakers, and he's like, you know, if you're into Jordan, they're releasing a sneaker tomorrow. I'm like, what are you talking about? Oh, well, Nike does these special re-releases. They have all these series of Jordan shoes, and I didn't know there's like 30 plus. Like Jordan 1, Jordan 2, there's all of these different Jordans, and then they will go back and re-release them in different colorways. So upstairs right now is my first pickup from them. I think it's the Jordan 6s, and they're in like Bulls colors. I was like, that looks cool, and it was happening that day as I was into it, so I had to pick them up. But I might have a new...
You have a whole closet set aside? Are you ready to go down this
get a like, whole rack. Yeah, he's like... My buddy Justin was like, oh yeah, I'm really excited to see your... studio background just be full of shoes now because apparently like nobody wears these things, they just sit there on shelves.
Yeah.
So yeah, look forward to the background here changing, everybody watching on YouTube.
I love it.
All right, Nick, what do you got? You got anything?
Yeah. So I've been on was it the last episode? I've been on like a World War One kick, which is like kind of like a perpetual thing, but the All Quiet on the Western Front Netflix movie. I found it kind of hard to watch actually because it's long and intense, but the opening, whatever 10 minutes of it is, even brutal. If you don't watch the whole movie
with the clothes washing or yeah. Like the reusing.
Yeah. That's crazy. So even if you don't watch the whole movie, just the first 10 minutes, it won a bunch of awards. I mean, it's not like it's a secret movie, but it's I watched it recently for the first time and it's a favorite.
Did you watch it with the subtitles or did you watch it dubbed?
I
believe it's all in German.
Mm-hmm. I watched it dubbed because I got the full immersive experience by watching it on my iPhone. And the text is a little small. So I was like, I'll just live with the dub.
Which were you doing like, it like while working out or something?
No, I'm just like at night, like late at night or like if I have a few minutes here and there with like if my kids are on iPads or whatever, and I can just chill out for a few minutes. But so I didn't even watch it in one sitting, which is probably also a mistake. But and I still liked it.
The director's just crying right now. Yeah,
exactly.
Shot on IMAX or what? You know,
yeah, someone poured their whole, like the. Yeah,
with Christopher Nolan would be throwing a fit because I think he doesn't even want people to watch his movies on TV. You know, it's only big screen IMAX.
It's better. It's definitely
certainly yeah
better.
Come on, Chris. My boy Chris. he's got a movie, Oppenheimer's coming out.
Oh, yeah.
I'm excited for that.
Yeah. Isn't that this June? Today's May 31st, so I think it's coming out June, right?
Yeah. I wanted to see Dunkirk. I'd never really meet the theater, but I wanted to see Dunkirk in the theater, but never did.
You know, tie into Santa Barbara here is I actually saw Dunkirk in Santa Barbara. And I have a buddy out there that I visit frequently, Brian. So when I come out there, I know you're not down there anymore.
I'm close enough. I mean,
yeah.
Hit me.
I want to come down and say hi and also Santa Barbara is like incredibly beautiful and nice. You got a good spot there. All right, guys, we did it. Thanks so much for being here. And do you have any places we'd like to send viewers and listeners? Do you have like a personal Instagram that you want people to check out, or do you want them just check out Nomad?
I keep my personal, but yeah, just check out Nomad Goods. Yeah, you can just Google it.
Just Google it. Find it the way everyone else finds it.
That's right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Brian.
We had a great day.
It's awesome.
All right, we'll see you later.
Yeah.